Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
A Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. This is Tech Talk. You're listening to WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. This is your host, Michael Kassler, and we have got just a blast of a show set up for you today. We're not only going to have our good friend Jay Garman joining us with a little bit of geek trivia, catching up from last week when we were not able to connect, but also to returning guest, Michael Miller of the Molehill Group. You can find him on Twitter at Molehill Group. Prolific author, great friend of the show, giving us some lowdown and info about Windows 8 and what you can expect from that, as well as talking about some of the changes in Facebook. And he's got a new book out called Easy Facebook that he's going to tell us why you need it and what it's about. And I think that's going to be some cool stuff we're going to talk about. I'm excited to hear about that. We're going to have a course talking about cool stuff. We're going to have some cool sites of the week at the end of the show, and also your song of the week, the Tech Talk song of the week. I love this song. This is a great song. Hopefully you're gonna like it too. So man, what a week, huh? What a week. Now tomorrow I want to put in one little chime in here for the fact that you've got to remember daylight savings time is tomorrow. That starts at 2 a.m. So you can throw your clock back before you go to bed and make sure you're online, unless you are like me and have one of those high-tech cool clocks by your bed. Yes, that's it. It's a tabletop clock that actually syncs with the internet and is able to go back on its own, and it's going to do that. I'm kind of looking forward to it taking care of itself. Also, of course, your phones and all that should automatically sync up. If your computer does not, you can configure it to follow a time server, and that's one way to keep up to date with your time without having to worry about setting it back. But you'll want to take a look anyways in the morning just to verify that it has caught up to itself. Having the time off by an hour can cause you problems, especially, of course, in Outlook and in, you know, your calendar contacts and all this kind of stuff. So you want to make sure that you catch up with that and get that on board. But, you know, the big news, of course, this last week has been Sandy, and New York City got Sandy blasted. Man, that thing was knocked down and out for the count. Crazy. We just haven't seen stuff like that. I'm gonna tell you, of course, that the radio station hearts and our prayers and our well wishes go out to everyone that was impacted there. It was neat to see the amount of compassion and energy that went into helping New York City and helping the whole of the East Coast, really. Keep going and stay together. With a big preponderance, too, of course, of what you're listening to right now. The radio. Radio was very involved with that and getting the word out of where people could go to get assistance, where they could go during the evacuation, what type of weather they could be expecting in the near future. And sometimes for many, many people there, radio was the only communication source they were having. Verizon, in fact, who supplies a tremendous amount of internet service and cell service and all this, is saying that it could take up to another 2 weeks to bring back phone, internet, and video or cable service. Their Fios networks just brought to their knees in some areas, as was everything, of course. But 2 whole weeks, can you imagine? Oh my gosh, this is crazy. Now, cell phone service is also out throughout a great deal of the East Coast. They do say that something like 65% or so of the cell phone service in areas that were cut off, not in all areas. Obviously, the coverage is much greater than that in most most areas. But in the areas that were cut off, 65% of those have already been brought back up and online. It may take another week or two, though, in those areas that are currently experiencing cell phone loss of connectivity to come back and online. So it'll be interesting to see how that comes back and how we get back and online. Now, as you, I'm sure, are well aware, too, the New York City Stock Exchange, for the first time since the 9/11 tragedy, was out for a full two days that they were out. Now, it's interesting to note, I think this is a really interesting technology story here, is that the stock exchange was down for 2 days. And that's, you know, that's, you would expect that, right? Because you've got this huge wall of water. You had the devastation, the damage. We all saw the videos on TV of the electricity stations literally exploding and cutting off power to huge swaths of the city and things like this. Now, what is interesting, however, is that Wall Street has a very well-defined business continuity plan. Now, business continuity, to make a definition here for you, is different from disaster recovery. You probably hear a lot about DR plans. You know, you need a disaster recovery plan, and that's ensuring that your data is not lost. That's ensuring that you can rebuild the equipment that you have in place if there is a disaster such as this. And disaster recovery plans are necessary and required, and that's one thing. That gets you back and running after some set amount of time. Business continuity is a little more intense, and it's a little more complex sometimes, because business continuity is not just saying I can restore my data and I can recover my current situation or hardware, but that I will be able to operate my business uninterrupted regardless of the current situation in certain parts of the country or world. And there is a business continuity plan for Wall Street, believe it or not. You may not believe it. The business continuity plan that they have includes working across different exchanges and doing a completely electronic exchange system. The group is called Arconis, and it would allow for the New York Stock Exchange theoretically to be able to run, like I said, as a completely electronic trading system and service without having to have physical presence at the New York Stock Exchange buildings. And the idea was that, you know, those trades that occur that would be New York Stock Exchange would have an N in front of them and all of this other stuff. And this was ready to go. And there was a lot of discussion and debate about this last week when Sandy was making landfall as to, do we do this? Do we go and do a full-on, completely electronic trade and do trading for a day or two in completely electronic ways? And the decision was made to not take the chance with it. You know, and there's some good reasons for that. One of the hallmarks of a good disaster recovery or business continuity plan is that you have fully tested it, that you have done a ground zero write-up and experimentation to make sure that this thing is going to work in as live a condition as you possibly can. That has never been done with the New York Stock Exchange business business continuity plan, and so because of that, and because of the fairly recent issues that have happened with electronic trading, minor issues, minor bugs, algorithms fighting each other and sending the stock market into tumult in literally a matter of instants, they made the decision to say no. Even with human intervention, even with human watch on this electronic trading system, we don't want to take the chance. And they said, boom, we're not going to do it. And so they were down for 2 days. And, you know, it's I find it a little disturbing that that one of the largest organizations that's a key to our economy and a key to the financial flow and well-being of the country was just not prepared for this. Essentially, they hadn't taken all steps to make sure that they could continue operation without a in the event of a disaster such as this. So and there's a lot of other companies that got nailed too. I don't know if you especially if you're small mid business size organization have started considering and contemplating the idea of using cloud services for your communications. That's a big deal right now. The company I work for, we're doing it too. Everybody's getting on board with it. ShoreTel was one of the earlier companies to get into that mix. And they have ShoreTel Sky, which is a cloud service provider across the entirety of the U.S., which uses a variety of carriers to provide this cloud-based communication service. Wonderful stuff, good stuff, especially, as I said, for your SMB market. Makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, their business continuity plan did not take into account the idea that maybe the East Coast and several data stations that they had located there would be impacted simultaneously. They lost service not just on the East Coast where you would expect it, but that actually filtered out through the rest of the country, including people in Chicago and Evanston. If you had ShoreTel Sky, you might have had some problems. Now, you can go to ShoreTel.com if you are one of these individuals, and you can look at their blog. They've got updates. They're trying to keep people abreast of what's happening with it. But it's a dangerous and damaging situation. And that's why I think a lot of companies try to talk to you, try to provide, if you're going to go with a cloud solution, that maybe you consider not just a fully cloud-based solution, but you can also create your own private cloud solutions. You can leverage, if you've got sites in various locations throughout the country, you can leverage that to actually create a more secure and stable environment for your communications than you can with a fully cloud solution. And we saw that happening. I think there's a lot, I think we're going to hear about in the near future a lot of good and bad about some of these technologies that we're starting to rely more and more heavily on, and cloud solutions is one of those that this is really going to kind of, run out of the woodwork. Some of the companies that aren't doing the due diligence they need to, and some of those companies that are really have got a structured and strong, stable network and system that's allowing people to continue in the face of disaster. And this is one of those. If you're using Google, that's obviously a cloud service. I don't believe that the people in New York were affected. If they had internet access, they could get on Google. That was not an impact. So, it's a mixed bag. As I said, it's going to be interesting to see over the next couple of weeks here how things shake out and what people wind up thinking about some of these technologies and uses that they've had for so long. Hey, I'm going to give our good friend Jay a call right now. See if I can bring him on first thing this morning. As I said, we've got Mike Miller coming on in just a little bit, so I want to make sure we have ample time to work with him as well.
Hello?
Good morning, Mr. Garman. How you doing, sir?
Not too bad. About yourself, sir?
Pretty good, pretty good. High and dry. Doing a lot better than a lot of my East Coast friends, that's for sure. And you work for a company that's got a big East Coast presence, right?
Yeah, they're in Boston, and Boston did pretty okay. There were some power issues, but nothing terribly crazy. No serious flooding or anything like in New York and New Jersey. I'm going to refrain from making any of the obvious Jersey Shore jokes because I think they speak for themselves.
Wrath of God. That's all I have to say. it was pretty clear there. the situation found himself in a situation he couldn't get out of. I personally was sitting here talking about some of the stuff, and this kind of impacts on what you guys do with Backupify. I was talking about, this is a situation where it's kind of running out some of the concerns that people have with relying on different types of technologies and ways that they use their systems. The New York Stock Exchange is an example. I used ShoreTel Sky, the cloud communication system, which also had huge outages across the country, as examples of people relying upon cloud services to be there. And then you have a fairly isolated disaster such as this one, you know, just in these couple of areas in on the East Coast, and you got people all over the country that are being affected by it.
Yeah, just from my own personal experience, we use an agile project management cloud-based service called Trello at my place of business, and they were down for basically the first couple of days of last week because all of their servers are in New York. I mean, they're in downtown Manhattan. It's just sort of, you know, they put up a 404, and, you know, they had some failover services in terms of being able to put the notice up, but it's like, we're underwater with no diesel generators. We'll be back up on Wednesday. And I think it's the other part of, you know, being a guy who's written some about disaster recovery is there's this little acronym in the industry called RTO, Restore Time Objective. It's not that you can't ever come back. It's how fast you come back and how much you're willing to pay for that speed of recovery. Yep. And, you know, we got along without Trello for a couple of days, and it wasn't a big deal. And, you know, we knew enough to keep working on projects, and it wasn't an extended outage. So there's sort of some balancing act to do there. But a lot of folks sort of don't get this whole notion of there are ways you can lose the service other than a hard drive crashing.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of like, well, you know, I'm set. I'm in the cloud. They've got backups, so it won't. So what if a hard drive crashes? It's like, yes. Then in a physical individual machine, a hard drive shredding itself is the single biggest threat to your data, and almost every cloud system out there solves that problem. I mean, there's a lot of numbers on it, between something between 40% and 75% of all data losses on a personal desktop or laptop are due to hard drive failure.
Okay.
So, okay. That's probably true of servers too. So that's, you know, okay, they're rated and they're mirrored and that's all fine. But there are other ways of losing data. You know, Backupify, where our whole thing is user error, because that's always been the number two cause. And there's no way software can tell the difference between, oops, I didn't mean to do that, and yes, please delete everything I own.
Exactly.
There's just no way to figure that out. If you say delete everything, it takes you at your word.
Yep.
We haven't figured out computers yet that do what you want, not what you say. if you say to do something dumb, it's going to do it. And so we're sort of the backup for that. But there's as this storm proved, there's a whole bunch of other things that can go wrong, like, your server's fine. We've got your data. We have no power to turn on the server and get it to you.
Yes. Or we have no phone lines or no internet connection to provide you with the data that's available here as well. And that was one of the things that I was just talking about, was that there's also a difference in a very clear set of protocols and differences between defining a disaster recovery plan versus a business continuity plan. And you may not need some of the things, like you guys clearly, even without Trello, you were able to continue your normal operation, you know, essentially. And those are the type of planning and things that that need to happen, and that unfortunately the New York Stock Exchange didn't do, you know, quite all the way to the end of what they needed to actually get things in a continuous state.
Well, and I'll cut the NYSE a little bit of slack. They were willing to come back on, I think it was on Tuesday or Wednesday, with just electronic trading. And a lot of the old schoolers were like, no. We're not going to just electronic. Like, we got to have people in the pits doing old-fashioned screaming and yelling and throwing scraps of paper at each other.
Yep.
Or you can't play this.
Yep.
And that, to me, is a whole separate issue of, you know, I know people that freak out when the internet connection on their phone goes out and they don't know how to go on. And 2 years ago, they didn't even have it.
Yeah.
Like, really? You don't know how to conduct yourself if you can't check Gmail right now.
Well, the main thing that I took issue with their plan for that, I think that they had the plan in place and all that, is that they've never actually tested it. They haven't done any testing in live conditions, and that maybe that's why. Maybe no one will let them. They're like, you know, if we can be down there screaming and in person, you know, we don't even want to take, you know, 2 hours to let you, you know, try this electronic only trading environment to make sure we can survive. Maybe this will spur some of that.
Well, and there's also something to be said for not having a failover site. You know, I have a lot of mixed feelings about Google and their services, because having been on both sides of it, being a consumer user and a business user, and seen a lot of the how the sausage is made and that sort of thing. And on the whole, I think they offer a good product. But I will say this for them. They're very explicit about if you're a paying Google Apps user, we mirror in two geographically distinct data centers your information.
Mm-hmm.
And within 24 hours, we'll get you back up and running. Even if, and it almost explicitly says this, even if Mountain View falls in the ocean, you'll be back up in 24 hours. They have that level of mirroring. So short of the actual entire continental United States like being obliterated, that stuff will come back up. But the key point there is within 24 hours.
Yep.
You know, even Google, who literally mirrors across the country and owns proprietary fiber between some of their data centers, more than they're probably willing to talk about, even they concede to, if there's a serious disaster, it may take us a day to get you back up.
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, this whole notion of the cloud is bulletproof is kind of a fantasy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and I work, and I also too, I've been on both sides of the table with that. And that's one of the newer services that we're starting to develop at NEC is cloud based communications. But kind of the stance we're taking with a lot of it is, you know, it really depends on your organization and how much risk you're willing to take for this type of stuff. A hybrid solution or a mix of a private cloud and corporate cloud might make more sense for a lot of organizations than diving headfirst into the whole cloud situation.
Well, and there's also this interesting tension, and Cory Doctorow does a great job of talking about this, how, you know, a lot of content providers love the idea of the cloud because basically it just turns every device into a thin client,
mm-hmm.
and all they got to do is stream to it. And but the problem with that, especially here in the United States, where our cellular network is practically paleolithic compared to the rest of the world, is that storage and low power processing gets exponentially cheaper and faster, way more so than connectivity throughput does. You know, the iPod and the iPad can store so much more than they could 5 years ago, but really there's not that much more bandwidth to be had over cell networks than there was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get in this whole tension of, yeah, the cloud's great because, you know, you don't risk anything on the device you're controlling, and the nightmare scenario of the sales rep leaving the unencrypted laptop in the coffee shop with all of the important business data on it, you know, that goes away with the cloud. But you're still into, you know, okay, but he's still at the mercy of connectivity. You know, as a guy who spends a fair amount of time on airplanes, you know, I get a lot of good leisure reading done on airplanes because there's not a whole lot of work I can actually do without internet.
Yeah. 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 No, that's exactly right. That's very true. And you know, and there is that, it's funny you brought up the topic just because I had actually recently written a white paper, basically making the case that you need to protect your data, not your devices, because the effort to protect individual devices, especially in a bring your own device kind of world, is getting more and more difficult and essentially impossible. That shifting to a data protection scenario is a lot easier for organizations. But that is one of the big caveats to that whole thing, is that, yeah, you're absolutely right. People trying to get access to the data is problematic. It can be a tough thing depending on where you're located and what the, you know, if you're up in the air and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, one of the better products that illustrates this, and it's one that I literally can't live without in terms of my career, is Google Drive, the desktop client, where basically what used to be Google Docs is now a folder in my file system. And, you know, I've got it on all my computers, and it has an offline mode, and it does a pretty good job of, you know, if I am working offline on something that can be worked on offline, when I get connectivity back, it will try to resolve that difference. Where it gets into these weird scenarios is, you know, like I have to avoid doing updates on an airplane to a shared, you know, sales report, because there could be data collision where, you know, when it gets back on, you know, one of my colleagues could have updated the same field I've updated, and now it's sort of in this position of, well, I can't sync this because, you know, I don't know how to resolve that priority.
Yeah.
And so you get into these weird issues of, okay, you know, how do you – there's a whole lot of interesting data management technology still to be developed to handle those kind of situations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's been ubiquitous for a little while now. I know SharePoint's dealing with the same issues. I use Dropbox personally, but Dropbox really doesn't do a great job of that type of management either, sharing documents with people, as far as getting people to both be able to edit and use it at the same time. It's really not a good management tool for that. But I use it primarily as just a cloud-based storage for myself that is available with offline mode and online mode too. I think Sandy, as I said, I think Sandy is going to be somewhat of an interesting bellwether for how people in the future are going to choose to deal with cloud services, how they're going to deal with disaster recovery and business continuity plans. I think this will be somewhat as Katrina was, and somewhat as 9/11 was. That these are ways that people are going to look at how we're developing our companies and our systems to operate in the time of disaster. So it's hopefully some good will come out of it, one way or the other.
Absolutely, and I think anyone who offers business continuity planning is in a very good place right now.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, if there's anybody out there that's thinking of opening up, putting a shingle out for that, this is a very good time. Very good time. Hey, Jay, we should move along though. I've got our good friend Mike Miller, who's going to come on and talk to us about Windows 8 in just a minute. So I need to find out, and this is very apropos here too, since we're having difficulties with internet. A lot of people out there on the East Coast are the geek trivia question we've been waiting for the answer for was, what was the first message that was ever sent on the internet, or back when it was called ARPANET?
Yeah, the first message ever sent over the ARPANET, and this is in October of 1969, was actually two letters long, L and O. And before any of you think that this is some sort of like early leet speak for hello, and actually no, it was sent from UCLA to Stanford over the first router linked communication network of the ARPANET, which had exactly one router on it. So basically, it's a Trans California connection, and they were actually trying to send the login command between the from UCLA to the Stanford mainframe over the first ARPANET connection, and it crashed two letters in.
Well, now what was the text of the message that they wanted to send?
LOG, log, which the mainframe would have auto-completed to log in, because it would have recognized that. So, but they got literally 66% of the way through a three-letter command, and the net went down.
Oh, some things never change. Some things just never change.
It took them about 3 or 4 hours to get the connection back up again, at which point they did successfully log in from UCLA to the Stanford terminal. So that actually worked. So the first internet outage was actually 3 to 4 hours long.
And some 40 odd years on, and here we are. And it's still up and running and working. So not too bad. So what should we be thinking about for this coming week?
Well, I'm going to do some election trivia, but it's strictly nonpartisan for the sake of all of our sanity and decency.
Excellent.
The U.S. government requires and has required, not constitutionally, but since 1845, that the federal elections occur what some people call the first Tuesday of November, but it's actually the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, meaning it could be the first Tuesday in November, unless November 1st is a Tuesday, and then it's the second Tuesday.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. There is a reason they originally just wanted the first Tuesday in November, but there was a legal reason. There's a lot of apocryphal suggestions as to why, but there was a legitimate legal reason why they could not simply have elections on the first Tuesday of November. So it was the legal basis for the rather complicated federal law that said we have to have the elections on the first Tuesday after the first Monday.
Interesting. Interesting. Now that, I don't know. I was, when you first started talking, I was thinking, oh, I might know about this. An interesting thing people may not realize, too, is that having a single date for elections is also something that was not originally there. It used to be the states would determine when elections would occur, and they would all happen within the same year, but some states would have their elections as early as April and some as late as October. So...
Yes, and that generally wasn't a problem until the telegraph became very common, at which point you get what you have now, which is, oh, the states that voted early influence the voting of the states that vote late.
Yep, yep. Exactly, exactly. Well, Jay, thank you so much. I got to pull this to a close here, but, man, glad to hear things are going okay and you guys weren't too badly impacted by Sandy, and to tell our listeners, too, of course, that they can always find a lot more Jay with at jaygarman.net.
Absolutely, and they are welcome to come peruse all of my archived Twitter links there.
Beautiful, beautiful, and there's some good stuff, and also some links to the Evergreen top 10 lists and things that you've done throughout time for various places and institutions. All good stuff. All good stuff.
All right, have a good weekend, buddy.
Yeah, you too. You too. Thanks a lot, Jay. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
All right. Bye. Bye.
Jay Garman, and as I said, jaygarman.net is a great place to start for all your Jay, and you can also too find him on Twitter and all sorts of other places. Speaking of guys you can find all sorts of places, I think it's time right now that we give our good friend Michael Miller a call and see if we can connect with him. And I'm bringing him up right now. Now, Mike's, as I said, prolific doesn't even begin, I think, to describe Mike and his. Hey, Mike, do I have you on right now?
You do. I'm here.
Oh, fantastic! Oh my gosh, this is probably the most clear I have ever heard anybody online. This is fantastic. You must have a pretty decent little setup there.
Yeah, I'm actually using a very high-end headset. It works very well.
As I said, I'm literally just floored right now by the difference in our communication quality. We had you on just a few weeks ago, and it was a great conversation. But we should have been doing this Skype to Skype all the time. This
oh
is
yeah,
fantastic.
Well, it was a little bit of a one-sided conversation when my phone line went dead about halfway through it. So, yeah. Which is a problem. It's a recurring thing. So I keep a landline phone primarily to do radio shows like yours, and several times now my phone has just gone dead, can't even dial back in, no dial tone sort of thing. So why am I paying $70 a month for this stupid landline phone now?
Oh, exactly. My wife and I are going through this. She's just a touch resistant to give it up. She's almost there with giving up the landline, but we have the very, very occasional fax need, and yep. we have an alarm system that I'm going to convert over to a cell based alarm system, and then the only final last reason is I don't want to lose the number. The number is a phenomenal number. It actually ends in 1900. I'm not going to tell people what it is, but it's just a fantastic, it's a fantastic number. So we've got to switch it over to a cell or Google Voice or something like that to not lose it. So
actually, I'm glad you mentioned the alarms. I hadn't even thought of that. That's another issue. I've got the fax issue as well. So there's some reason to keep it, I suppose.
Yeah. This will be a topic for another show. It's actually, you'll probably wind up getting a book out of this if you do make the conversion. but there are some pretty decent options out there now, particularly if you've got internet connection in your house, or if you've got a decent strong cell signal in your area. You can get a lot cheaper options and options that don't require all of the wiring all over your house anymore.
Yep. Yeah, unfortunately, I have a cell phone carrier that begins with A and ends with T, which means I can't get cell phone service on one end of the couch in my living room.
Yeah, I know your pain. Absolutely. For work, I've got a neat little Bluetooth thing that connects to my landline, and so I have to keep my phone in one specific location of the house in order to receive calls through it. So.
Yeah, all this wireless stuff is great, except when it doesn't work. So there you go.
Yes, that's as the people in New York are finding out. And we were just speaking with Jay about that quite extensively. Speaking of other things that sometimes work and sometimes don't, of course, the topic of the day, and how do you like that segue, is... is Microsoft Windows. And you know, I'm like most people, I think, you know, I loved XP, kind of sort of hated Vista. I'm a fairly recent convert to 7 and have finally embraced it and really like 7. And now they've got Windows 8 and that's coming out. Is this a big difference from Windows 7?
It is a bigger difference than any other version of Windows. It's like going from Windows to Linux or something. I mean, it's totally different. I mean, Microsoft came at – you have to understand how Microsoft came at this. They're scared of Apple. They think that Apples and iPads are going to completely decimate the PC market, or at least some people within Microsoft think this. So they want to – and obviously they're not competitive in tablets. They don't have one. So they wanted to, you know, to go head-to-head with Apple. So they came up with an operating system. Actually, it's based on the Windows Phone operating system, if anybody out there uses that, which is an interesting operating system in that it's touch-based. So, you know, if you're using it on a touchscreen device, it's got these big tiles on it, and you just touch it with your finger and move this over here and swipe and that sort of thing. Yeah. And it works really good for that sort of thing. But they then applied it to the desktop, you know, to the billions of people who are running Windows right now. And it isn't like Windows at all. I mean, it isn't like an evolution in Windows. It is a different user interface, completely different. People are going to look at this and say, what in the world am I looking at here?
Yeah. Those initial pictures that I've seen of it, it really is very different looking. And I've wondered about that too, is, you know, I use a desktop, I use a laptop. I don't have anything right now with a touch screen to it. Does it operate well without a touch screen if you're using a mouse?
Well, you know, with a touchscreen, it's great, but for the 99.9% of us who don't have touchscreen devices, talk about playing to your user base here, yes, you can still use it without a touchscreen, but it is not intuitive and it is not easy. I mean, you know, everything you can do with your finger, you can do either with your mouse or with a keyboard. There are keyboard shortcuts, but there are no menus there to look at. This is one of my biggest gripes about it. Even on a touchscreen device, there are no visual cues. You know, you take a program, any program, Microsoft Word or whatnot, and you know that because of the menu system or because of the ribbon system that you can find this particular type of thing over here. Even if you don't use that command too often, there's a way to find it. There are visual cues. Well, this thing, you're just looking at a screen full of tiles. There's no menu, there's no start button, there's no visual cue. So to really use it, which I said you can use it with a mouse or with a keyboard, although it's a little more difficult, you have to remember all the cues. I mean, this is like going backwards 20 years where we had to remember all the command lines in DOS and all the macros in 1, 2, 3. It literally is like that. I mean, we're probably going to sell a lot of books because of this, because there are no cues to tell you what to do. I mean, I was sitting here, I hadn't used Windows 8 for a couple days, all right? I'm sitting here going, oh, wait a minute. Now, how do I display the options bar again?
Yep.
And I had to go to one of my books to look it up because I couldn't remember how to do it, and there were no cues to do it.
Boy, yeah, that's bringing back some great memories of I was a real Lotus hack, you know, and I could I remember getting in there and you know, man, I was really bummed when everything shifted to GUIs because it actually made things a little slowed down for me. But of course now, you know, yeah, you walk into so many different pieces of software, being able to at least have a little bit of contextual clue about where to get what you want is pretty important. And that's surprising they've taken that away from you.
Yeah, now to be fair, it's a complaint I have against any touchscreen operating system. I have the same complaint about Apple and the iOS. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are no visual cues on that. You know, so how many people know that if you swipe down from the top of your iPhone that you see your notifications, for example, because it's something you don't use all the time. But here's the deal. When you're using it on a phone, there aren't that many things you can do. So you only have to remember a few things. With a computer, there are tons of things you can do. How do you get to the settings? How do you get to the control panel? And they've got touch operations for every one of those. I mean, so there, you know, one of these things, like you do a four-finger swipe across the screen and something weird happens. I don't know what happens. But, you know, so there are dozens and dozens of these touch gestures that you can use. It's not just two or three, you have to remember. It is now dozens.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Or dozens of the corresponding keyboard shortcuts or dozens of the corresponding mouse movements. So, and that I think is an issue that somebody didn't think that through at Microsoft. They were so hell-bent on getting into the touch thing, and then, well, if it's touch, then everything's got to be touch, so let's do a special command to do this, no, who's going to remember all this? Some geek up in Seattle maybe, but not you and me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I know that they've added some things to try and reduce some of that confusion. Like there's something I've heard about called the charm bar, I think it is, something along those lines.
This is something that's, you know, just going to confuse everybody in the world. First of all, what in the world is a charm? I can tell you, in Windows 8, it's this little bar that floats in from the right of the screen, which, let me do it here on my own machine so I can see what is on it. It has settings. It has a link to the start menu. It has, I pressed the wrong button. I hate this darn thing. You press the wrong thing. It's got a search facility. So it's got like five different things. And they're kind of a program contextual sensitive. So if you're in a different program, you might have different charms. But I don't know whether it's an attempt to replicate some of what used to be on the start menu, but certainly not all of it. Mm-hmm. But it kind of floats in from the right hand of the screen and lets you do some things. But there's also an options bar that floats up from the bottom of the screen, which is very much program sensitive. It has different options for different programs. On some programs, there's another options bar that floats in from the top of the screen also, if you touch it the right way.
Okay.
That's... But the point is, you know, charms, where did that terminology come from? It's nothing that any of us have ever used. And, you know, even the gestures or the keyboard command to show it is not intuitive, but you do have to get to it sometimes. And it's, you know, it's just one new wacky thing we have to learn. While we are essentially forgetting everything we used to know about Windows.
Yeah.
You know, we used to know, there's a desktop. Oh, there's no desktop anymore. The desktop is now an app within this thing. And by the way, when you get to it, there's no start button and no start menu.
Mm.
So how in the world do you find anything if there's no menu?
Yeah.
That's an issue with Windows 8.
Yeah. No, that sounds like a big. No, I'm getting the impression that you're not fond of it. That you're thinking this might be one of those. The common rule of thumb is that, you know, every other release tends to be the one that you skip.
Well, I'm not even sure that's going to work in this point in time, because this is not an evolution. This is they should have called it something other than Windows, I think, because it is something other than Windows. Mm-hmm. One, I hope they sell a lot of it, because I've written a couple books and are talking about a third, and I'd like to sell some books. But aside from that blatant self-interest, I think if you have a touchscreen device, such as a tablet, mm-hmm. Such as maybe the new Microsoft Surface coming out, or some of these weird new hybrids that have just been released along with Windows 8, I think it is worth considering. I won't even recommend it then, because I think it even has some problems as a touchscreen operating system. But if you have a touchscreen device, I think you should consider it. If you don't have a touchscreen device, if you are using traditional desktop programs, like, again, 99.9% of us are, I would say stay away from it. I've got to get my wife a new PC, and it's like, I better buy one soon while I can still get Windows 7 installed on it, because she won't know what to do with it.
Yes, yeah, and in fact, I mean, just coincidentally, I'm helping out a couple here at the station who are they're a little bit older, and they've gotten to the end of the life of their current machine. They're looking for a new one, and they're going to places like Best Buy and to Tiger Direct and stuff, and they're telling them, you can't buy Windows 7 anymore. And I'm like, no, that's a bunch of hooey. You can definitely buy some Windows 7 still, but they're all really pushing and really hyping these new Windows 8 machines. And I think part of it is because, of course, in order to use it appropriately, you got to have that touchscreen piece, which is going to add a little cost.
Well, I think it's interesting. The new computers that have been announced, you know, concurrent with Windows 8, Only about 15 to 20% of them are actually touchscreen computers. Whereas, you know, so all these brand new Windows 8 machines, the majority of them don't have touchscreens on them, which means they're ineffective in using Windows 8. And the reason is because it costs more money to add a touchscreen. I mean, look, to get a notebook PC with a touchscreen on it, you're going to pay close to $1,000, maybe even a little bit more.
Yep.
Where the sweet spot of the market now is, what, $499, $599 or so for a notebook?
Yep, yep.
You know, so all of a sudden we're going to start, you know, I don't want to spend $500. I'll go ahead and spend $1,000 to get a touchscreen. No, most people aren't going to do that. The sweet spot is going to remain. The sweet spot is the sweet spot for a reason. And, you know, and if they don't have touchscreen devices on it, well, we're just going to all be forced to use Windows 8. And I think this is kind of the thing that if I were going to predict what's going to happen with this, obviously they're going to sell a lot of copies of Windows 8 because it's going to be installed on every PC. That, you know, so every new version of Windows is quote-unquote successful because of that.
Yep.
But in terms of upgrading older devices, it ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, even though they've got a very attractive upgrade offer right now, $39, $39.95, you can upgrade to the Windows 8 Pro.
Yeah.
From any version of Windows. I mean, that's great. And you do it all online. It's actually a very smooth procedure. It's the upgrade thing they've really got sussed out this time. But I wouldn't recommend anybody doing it if you're using computers like we've been using them for the past 20 years. The Windows 8 isn't going to do it for you. So what I think will happen, I think what the next version of Windows is, or whatever the next iteration is, I think that Windows 7 or some, you know, Windows 7.1 or whatever they call it, will be around for a long, long time. I think Microsoft will accede at some point in time and let manufacturers keep putting Windows 7 on some of their machines.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think I'd have to agree with you too, just because I know how long that adoption cycle is for corporations.
Oh, they're still using Windows XP in most corporations, right?
Exactly.
That's 12 years old now.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, me sitting here at the radio station, that's what I've got up, and that's what we're talking on here is a couple of Windows XP machines. So I see that as being an issue. Now, all that being said, though, I have to admit that the advertisements and the use case scenario stuff that I've seen for that Surface tablet and for the Windows 8 thing, where it's in play, where you've actually got a portable touchscreen device that you can snap into, you know, like a desktop environment, and then you can pull it out and bring it in front of your kids, then you can pull it from there and take it into a presentation. That is pretty cool stuff, and that looks very useful.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we're talking about Windows 8 on a tablet such as the Surface, I think it's a totally different discussion. Now, you know, because that's what the operating system is made for. So then you've got a head-to-head comparison. You say, well, let's compare the Windows 8 tablet with the iPad tablet. And they're two totally different approaches to doing tablet operating systems, but they're both valid, and I think that is a good comparison. Mm-hmm. But in terms of desktop or notebook use, I mean, even if you've got a touchscreen notebook or a touchscreen desktop, like an all-in-one, you've got an ergonomic issue. You get your hands perfectly positioned on the keyboards. You got your little fingers there on F and J, you know. And then all of a sudden, you've got to reach up another 6 inches to touch the screen.
Yeah.
That's not good ergonomics. I mean, it is, and it's different to stretch up than to touch the screen than it is just to move to the right to hold a mouse. It is an ergonomic issue, I think.
Yep. Yep. Now, I could see that being ameliorated somewhat by having a, you know, going back to the days, especially if they do them a little bit better than they used to, instead of using a mouse, having like a touchpad and having one of those built into a keyboard or you know, easily available to your hands, as opposed to having to reach up and touch and be able to touch on a touchpad.
Well, and that is another issue. With Windows 8, some touchpads, well, presumably all of them, but let's just say some because we know how this works, are kind, let's call it touch-enabled, so that you can use some of the gestures that you would use on the screen on the touchpad itself. So like the pinch-to-zoom sort of thing.
Yeah.
Theoretically, or at least on a new machine anyway, you're going to be able to use the touchpad to do that sort of thing.
Okay, yeah, because I could see that making it a little, I have a tough time, I think, as you do, picturing, you know, walking among a bunch of cubicles with people working and typing and then constantly reaching up and swiping and touching to try to bring menus down and change fonts and things like this. You know, you either go back to the command line stuff that we're used to, like I was talking about with Lotus, or you got to have something that's a little closer to you. Otherwise, you're gonna have a lot of repetitive strain injury.
A totally different type of carpal tunnel there. But I will be honest with you, at least in my experience, and I'm an old DOS kind of guy, I found that Windows 8 works better with keyboard commands than it does with the mouse.
Okay.
If you can remember them, mind you. But, you know, because some of the things you have to do with the mouse to replicate the touch gestures are just real touchy. Like, you got to hover over just the right spot in the corner for this thing to happen. Whereas if you just, you know, do, you know, control Q or whatever, it happens quite easily on the keyboard. So yeah. I found myself using the keyboard commands more than I was using the mouse.
Now that's, you mentioned like this touchiness, and that reminded me of one review that I read that talked about the new password screen that you can have access to, where you basically draw on it, and as long as you draw the same way every time you get in, but that can be pretty touchy too.
Oh yeah. I mean, anything that, especially when you're using, it would be easier to do with your finger than it would be to try and draw the thing with the mouse. I tried to do the visual touch word password thing with this, and I can't do it with the mouse. I'm a bad mouser, but I can't get it to go where I want it to go when I'm doing, you know, drawing little circles around people's eyes on a picture, which is kind of how that visual password works.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that one's kind of a solution in search of a problem also. I hear a whole lot of people, hey, can I just draw on my screen instead of typing in a password? No, let's take a few minutes to draw a picture.
So. Yeah. Well, I see that as being kind of a continuation of that adoption of the whole tablet concept, you know, where my Android tablet, for example, rather than a password, you know, you just swipe along to the outside of a circle kind of thing. You know, and even your iPod and iPads, you know, you have to click, you know, swipe to unlock.
Yeah.
So this is, I kind of get it, but yeah, with doing it with a mouse is going to be tough. Now, the other big thing that I think needs to be mentioned is how thoroughly integrated into the Microsoft ecosystem your Windows machine now has to be, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you now have the same interface across all devices. That was Microsoft's goal. I think it's a stupid goal because the same interface does not work equally well on all devices. But, you know, Apple doesn't do that. They say, hey, this works on the desktop, we're going to use this. This works on the iPad, we're going to use this. But Microsoft, nope, we're going to have the same. We're going to call it Windows. We're going to put it on everything. So whether you're using an Xbox or a phone or a tablet or a desktop, you don't have to relearn anything. It's the same interface. So that's what we have. In addition, with Windows now, you don't, at least by default, you don't log in locally. To log onto your computer, you actually log onto your Microsoft account.
Yeah, exactly. I'm compelled by that. I think that's a neat idea, but I'm also not sure that I like the idea that I have to have Microsoft know a whole bunch of things about me in order for me just to use my computer.
Well, you can switch that off and go back to local login, but then you don't take advantage of a lot of the nice things in Windows 8, such as, you know, I'm looking at the start screen now, and all the tiles that you have are similar to an icon on an iPad, okay? Mm-hmm. But the tiles are live. So I'm looking at messages coming forth on being displayed on the mail tile. I'm looking at social media updates being displayed on the people tile. I'm looking at live stock reports and news stories being displayed on the tiles. And it's all because I'm logged into that account as that lets me do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and plus all your information follows you anywhere. So I can log on to any Windows 8 machine with my Microsoft account and see the exact same desktop.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, that's kind of nifty. I have to say, I do like that. That seems like a good thing, particularly for people that do have a desktop, a tablet, a laptop, you know, this type of thing. They don't have to reconfigure every single,
right,
you know, component of it to get the use out of it. So that, yeah. I can see that. Mike, we've only got like a minute or two left here. And so I'm going to redirect this just for a second. Now, Facebook is making changes to their timeline. They're trying to make things easier, but I know that you also have just recently published a book that is designed to help people make a little more sense out of Facebook too.
Yeah, and especially for first-time users or people who are just kind of casual users, want to get more up to speed. I've got a new book out called Easy Facebook. It's one of these four-color, all-visual books. So if you like to look at pictures as opposed to read a lot of words, it's a good book for you. And it'll take you through, you know, everything that Facebook does. And it's the first Facebook book I've ever done that didn't change by the time it got printed. You know, Facebook is always changing stuff. For some reason, I lucked into it. And what I wrote about is actually what's still out there, which is amazing.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty tough to keep ahead of that curve, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah, these online services, it's like it's shooting at a moving target, you know?
Yep. Yep. And of course, they are, like I said, they are changing things a little bit, but not dramatically this time. It's just a very small change, I guess, to the timeline.
No, well, they're changing their algorithm so that you actually get fewer posts that you see in your news feed. And they think that, and that may be a good thing, it may be a bad thing. It kind of depends on the individual, how much you want to see from people.
Yeah, I could see that. Well, you know, and particularly during this election cycle, I could have probably taken a lot fewer posts than I actually got. But
I solved that by being unfriended by a lot of people. So that
Oh man, and you and I have had our discussions online, which I've got to say again, I love it. We may not agree on things, but don't ever take anything I say as being angry. I'm always passionate, but I love the dialogue, and I think that's one of the really for people, like you mentioned, first timers that aren't on Facebook yet. It is a wonderful forum for being able to converse with friends and with acquaintances and people that you don't get a chance to in a way that you never would connect otherwise. You know, I don't believe it's possible to do it in a different format, at least not today.
Well, you know, in terms of our discussion on Facebook, I like to think that we have the same goals but different strategy on how to get there. So,
yep. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. Now, there's other people that I've found, they maybe have slightly different goals.
Well, it is amazing. You get on Facebook and you connect with, you know, people you haven't seen since grade school or high school or whatnot, and you realize that how did these people who grew up in the same place I did, listen to the same music I did, you know, the same teachers I did, grow up to be just so incredibly wrong in the way they think?
Exactly. Oh man. But you know, at the heart, yeah, I think you do find that there's a lot of good in people, and people really are trying to do good by themselves and their family and their country, and just have slightly different ways of doing it. And that's what makes us great too. You know,
I think I'd rather look at some of the political posts than more cat pictures.
There is that. Yes, I'm pretty well done with the cat and animal pictures. Mike, I apologize. I've got to pull us to a close here right now, though. Where can people who are interested in your books, who are interested in finding out more about Windows 8 or want to know, I mean, you've got just this incredible breadth of things that you've produced. Where can we find more stuff like that?
Just go right to my website, molehillgroup.com, molehillgroup.com, and everything will be listed somewhere there.
Beautiful. And of course, if they do a search for Michael Miller on Amazon or any of the other major book selling locations, they can find that stuff too. And
they can follow me on Twitter at Molehill Group is my Twitter handle.
Beautiful. And they should. I'll say that. They absolutely should. It's a lot of good stuff. Michael, it's just great having you on. Again, we're going to do it soon. If we don't get a chance in December, how about in the new year when maybe we're a little more settled with Windows 8?
Sounds good to me. Good talking to you, Michael.
Take care. Have a great day. Michael Miller, man, what a great guest. I always love having him on. And funny thing is, too, is he actually lives almost right around the corner from where I grew up in Minnesota. Just a complete and utter coincidence, and he moved in there. He's a newbie in that area. Gosh, I wish I had time here for all the cool things that I want to do. We've got cool sites of the week I wanted to get to. I don't believe that's going to happen today. But what I do want to do for sure is I want to leave you with a song of the week. The song of the week this week is going to be, how about if we do, I love this artist, Nellie McKay, a little old school kind of sound to her normally, but not on this song. This is called Sorry, and this is a cleaned up version. So I'm playing it live on the radio, but if you listen to it in its original album format, it is a little NSFW. Hey, reminder, tomorrow. Set those clocks back an hour. It is daylight savings time. You have been listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois. And this is Sorry by Nellie McKay.
I shouldn't apologize so much. That it's jive, it's a crutch I just use when I'm judged. Being fudged by a face I can't erase and can't see, cause I'm misplaced to Dossier or Monty Python CD or something stupid like that. But Jesus, is that so bad to make my ego go splat like a tire going flat or fat on a Big Mac? I'm being attacked. If it's at you bureaucrats, you can just apologize back. But I don't know when it comes and it goes, all the highs and the lows and this motionless cycle says when sorry for the mess, the stupid way I'm dressed. I guess I failed my test. Oh, don't you know I'm sorry for my views? I must have been confused. And yet you know that really I'm sorry for you. Well, now I don't mean to offend much. Just comprehend when you're female and you're fencing and fen-fen to no end. And no Zen guide to men will help you fend off the brethren. And then the pen appears and build them the oxygen network or the sword of spirit fork or the board pork-fed board. It's a mooring post, the whore you'll miss the most when you're away. When you're in snowshoe PA doing some play from backstage that deals with AIDS and race and gays and relationships and ballet. And then you're like, hey, what'd you say? I can just sing my troubles away. But then you're cause you gotta make a buck and the whole world sucks and you're ugly duck that's dying line. Trying to slump, there's no one buying, there's always doubt. Capreen and dream and scream and chop your life's afflictions, fiction of fouls. But I don't know when it comes and it goes, all the highs and the lows and this motion cycles this and of sorry. I'm part of the liberal theology that's leading us to Harry Carey. It's like a mythology almost, like a malingering ghost. As we slowly decompose, rotting in the grave of the polls, crying for Senator Wellstone, and then proceeding to moan at our own supposed sabotage of the elections at home. Oh, somebody phone home. The American people have spoken. Now is that certain? Maybe those nice Midwestern folks are just joking. In any case, when he's in dope and choking, moping and sobbing. Come on, you disheartened and dobbing. Say